actual medicinal benefits. From the studies that I've read, we don't really see any.
Could there be? Sure, maybe. But for most, in most cases, it is more of a placebo. More of someone thinking they're getting better, so they feel better,
but it doesn't actually do anything for them. So they're killing these animals to feel better.
Well, it's not really doing anything for them. Why are other people out there still killing them to provide this product? This stuff is worth lots of money.
One dead tiger can feed a village for a couple of years.
They'll go out and kill them. They'll go out, they'll kill them, because it's big, big business. All sorts of money from the bone, blood, all the animals, everything. And the trophy, the skin, is worth a lot as well. They'll go out, that's how they make their living. It's been kind of difficult for these people to do this, but lately things have flipped back, and now it's becoming a little bit easier. We'll talk about why that is. But this traditional medicine use has been around for all sorts of different animals. Rhinos, elephants, we see it a lot. Lots of animals that are poached just for these medicines. The problem, we normally have some amount of poaching. We've had poaching since we've had people, right?
Now that we have automatic weapons, it's a little easier. Now that we have big guns,
sniper rifles, all that good stuff, it's a little easier to take down those animals. But they have more difficulty bouncing back now as well.
It's not just that we're killing them, we're also destroying their ability to reproduce. How are we doing that?
We're making it so that they can't get proper resources to make agile. Remember that these big, fierce animals, remember I had that slide, big, fierce animals are rare because they're sitting on top of the food chain. They don't get as much energy.
What those big, fierce animals have to do in order to get an appropriate amount of energy is hunt in a larger range. They need more space so that they can get more food. So that they're not just wiping out their food source,
they're just eating the ones they, a few here, a few there. New ones are born and come up, a few over here again, a few over there again, so on and so forth.
So that they're not just wiping out their own food sources.
When you have huge forests, alright, we got this big nice forest. We got town A, town B. People want to get from town A to town B. How are they going to get from town A to town B? They're going to make a road right through the forest. What happens when they make a road through the forest? They destroy all these trees. They fragment the range of the animals in this forest. Now, there are two different ranges, two different populations that are trapped not by a real geological event,
but there is a geological barrier now.
That barrier is beating cars. Whole new problem, whole new predator. As the other thing we see is, as City A spreads and gets bigger, City B, oh, people want to get over to that road. City B gets a little bit bigger. They want to get over. See how it starts going? We start breaking into these things from different directions. We see this not just in Asia, not just in Africa.
We see this everywhere. We see this in the United States.
We have some nice little added benefits
in our national forest system,
okay, our wildlife system. We have taken some very large plots of land and sectioned them off and said, you are not building here. We're keeping this. That's very, very, very important.
It's also very, very important not to build roads through those things. Because what happens when you build a road through it?
You fragment it, you cut it off, and you reduce the overall use of that land. You make it less worthwhile to have it.
And the more roads that you're allowed to put through it, the less and less worth it has until eventually somebody in the government will say, sure, get rid of it. We don't need that national park anymore.
When in reality, what we're doing is we're destroying one of the last few ranges for the animals that live there. So should we build roads through national parks? Not in my opinion. But that's one of the few opinions I will actually voice strongly against that. These animals, they need these large continuous ranges to get the food they need,
to find the mates they need. You don't want to mate with your sister, right?
We saw that that can cause those mutations, any rare alleles that you might have, to be more likely to be expressed, to make your children more likely to die,
to be less successful.
So you don't want to mate with someone who's closely genetically related to you. You want to mate with somebody way different. In order to find somebody way different,
you got to go a little way, right? You can't just knock next door if you're a tiger, you know? They're not different.
If they're really close to you, they're probably family. You've got to be able to find new mates. This is for all animals in general. What else breaks up these ranges, these large forests? Well, logging, farming. One of the big problems in Asia right now with logging is illegal logging.
You have a lot of people who, again, not a lot of money. So what do? They're trees. If I cut those trees down and sell them, I'll have enough money to live through the winter. You don't blame the people for wanting to live through the winter. You don't blame them for the action. But the action still has consequences for those animals. It still hurts the animals greatly. So again, this becomes a really tough statement when people don't have the resources to stay alive without them.
So you have illegal logging. That's a big problem. What's the easiest way to start a new fire?
You burn down the forest. All those resources, all those nutrients that we were having such a hard time getting, right? Remember when we were walking around outside, we saw the legumes, like the mesquite, that were pulling down nitrogen. What's the easiest way to chuck that soil full of nitrogen? Burn the trees down. All that ash, nutrient rich. So what you do is you section an area, you burn it down, you plant a couple generations, and then you go and burn a new section down because it's more cost effective for you to burn down those other trees than it is to plant one of those pea plants that will bring nitrogen back into the soil. It's cheaper to just say, heck with it, I'm burning down more forests. So that's what they do. Those are what are really, really endangering the populations. When they can't get further and far enough to get these things, then all of a sudden, they can't make it. Notice where the range of these Siberian tigers, where this is. Okay, we've got China, Russia, Mongolia. We're going along this one big river. Population, the tiger population was shooting down for a very long time in the 50s. We were worried about it because people were really poaching. The tiger population bounced back already once. How did it do it? Two big things. Two really big things. Well, the first reason, from 50 until, anyway, the Cold War. Save the tigers. Why did the Cold War save the tigers? Nobody's coming in. Nobody's going out. Nobody's doing anything that we don't want them to do. Shooting tigers, that's unnecessary. You're not doing it. So people didn't get to shoot tigers. So what happened? Those tigers in Russia were able to breed.
So as long as they stay on that side of the river, and as long as they stayed on that side of the river, they were all right. So the tiger population in Russia, way up
over time.
The tiger population around in other places
kept dwindling.
Nowadays, there's another person, there's another thing in Russia that's trying to keep the tiger around. And that's their current leader, Putin. Vladimir keeps doing some really interesting, odd little campaign things, right around shirtless on horses and hunt tigers. And now he has a tiger as a pet. It's in a zoo. But they gave the tiger as a pet. All this really, he's an odd fellow. But he keeps promoting the tiger for the Russian people. I think he might be trying to make it like a gimmick thing for him, something political. But that's good. That's good for conservation. He has really been going towards conservation of the tiger in Russia, and hence pushing that for other countries to be more interested in the conservation efforts. No matter what the animal is, there has to be a range for it. There has to be some natural habitat for it. Tigers don't really breed well. No animal really breeds well in captivity, except for mice, bacteria, right? Other animals just don't really breed well in captivity.
If all we have are captive tigers, we won't have tigers. All it will take is one virus that can jump, one bacteria that can jump from people to tigers, and they'll all wipe out because they will have no genetic diversity. They'll just go away. One day we'll have tigers, one day, all gone.
So we need to keep these ranges, otherwise, they're gone. This is one of our big ranges that we're really focusing on because at Amur River, we can protect it a little bit more effectively, this natural border. There are a lot of natural old growth forests there. So it's the perfect range area. The part that's kind of scary right now is, right, there's some crazy stuff going on here, and it's right there, right? So that's a whole new problem for the tigers.
But that can be a whole new problem for all of us, right?
Okay, so we talked about population size and density. Okay, size is overall, density, specific areas. Each of these fragmentations can really be big alterations over that population density as well. You can get a whole lot of tigers stuck in one area and very few stuck in another. That's going to cause some genetic differences. We talked about logistic growth, and then logistic growth, that S-shaped curve, that S, the top of the S is where we're getting to carrying capacity. That capacity that the environment has to support this number of animals indefinitely. As we fragment these ranges, we actually greatly reduce their carrying capacity. We cut it down. The overall carrying capacity for the whole unit after it's cut in half is greatly reduced, even though you would initially think that it should have the same carrying capacity.
It doesn't because of the blocking of interaction between the animals.
There might be a specific resource on one side that's not as plentiful on the other. All of a sudden, can't make it. Yeah, how they move, patrol, everything. I mean, it's just like taking someone from another culture and throwing them in a new place. They're going to be very confused as to what's going on. Going to throw everything off. Just the same idea. We saw the population overshoot in reindeer and how the population totally crashed. I may reference that again at some point. We talked about predation and competition and then symbiosis. We saw inter and intra-specific competition, right? Different species interacting. We're really just looking about rare resources in those occasions. But when it's our same species, we're willing to go further. We're willing to be meaner. We're willing to be tougher. We're desperate sometimes. In symbiosis, we've got three different types. You'll want to be able to remember those three different types and think about what they really mean. With mutualism, both are benefiting. Something good has to happen for both for it to be mutual. Commensalism is when it's okay, sure, you're not bothering me, do whatever it is. I know it helps you out. Okay? Whatever that is, yeah, go ahead. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't hurt me. Parasitism is all one-sided. Totally one-sided. Correlation and causation, extremely important, right? Not just in science class, but in life in general.
Just because two things happen in tandem doesn't mean that one is always causing the other.
That's something that a lot of people will try and use to mislead you. Because this happened, at the same time this happened, I'm going to say that this caused that, and that that person or that thing or this or that is bad because of it. Is that accurate?
No.
If somebody makes a decision and it does something like that, that's accurate. That's causation, right? If somebody makes a decision and it causes something, absolutely, that's causation. But if two things happen in conjunction at the same time, does one necessarily cause the other? Not necessarily. You've got to look at the facts and look at what's going on. But oftentimes, that is something that will be used to mislead. Remember, thermodynamics, right? Keep coming back to physics. Keep coming back to chemistry.
Keep coming back to how it all comes together. It all works together.
First law is matter can't be created or destroyed. Second law, no energy transfer is perfect. Nothing's perfect. And remember that the second law helps apply these feeding levels, these trophic levels. And an application of those trophic levels is, again, the tigers that we were talking about today.
How they need a longer range because they're high up in the trophic levels. They're on top. So they need to feed on quite a few different organisms in order to be successful.
If you reduce the amount of different organisms they can eat, they aren't going to make it. Remember these terms we had talked about, but I didn't make a sheet of terms this time, right? I didn't really just make a sheet of terms and hand it out. Make sure that's a really useful tool. So think about it. Try and find terms that I bold in the lectures, that I talk about or repeat often.
Make one of these kind of sheets.
Make something to make it easier to study. Food chains versus food webs. A chain is a direct relation, one to another. The web is more of the real interaction. The web is a better display of what's actually happening. Talk about the greenhouse effect and how it actually is one of the main reasons we can survive. Pretty important. We're hoping that something else will start taking up some of the CO2 and help us.
Keep us from, well, overheating.
And having some serious problems when it comes to flooding. and other issues. Peppered moth, we talked about them last lecture, right? The white morph and the black morph.
As the Industrial Revolution happened, we had a big switch on which ones were more likely to survive.
We had to establish where views were before. Oh, and it was, I looked that up, in the 50s, the Pope said, we talked about the scale, the reason we needed all this information about religion, why? So that we understood where the people prior to Darwin were coming from. When Lamarck, when they start talking about these changes, it doesn't make sense to us because we can see it not working on people. But to them, people were different than animals. That was a key. That was a big issue in establishing a lot of what we figured out. Gradualism, uniformitarianism, okay, Hutton and Lydell, we're giving ourselves time, and we're seeing things progress. Then we talk about Jean-Baptiste. He goes out on a limb, and like I said, it breaks out underneath it.
Guy was really smart. He did a lot for science, actually. He did a whole lot for science. We wouldn't really have paleontology as a field.
He is the father of paleontology. He's the one who really set up that field, who really pushed and made it work out. He's setting up these first ideas, but he's making a few mistakes.
He's assuming that there's a goal, and there isn't. Evolution is not goal-oriented. In evolution, it is random chance and who is better.
I don't know that having two extra arms would make me more effective as a human, but I think it probably would. Now, can I choose to grow two more arms? No. Can I choose to have my child have two extra arms? No. There's no choice involved. There's no goal involved. It's all building and random. But there's selection on those that are better, those that work more effectively. So it's not perceived quality, it's actual effectiveness in the field. Remember Darwin, why in the world did he get on a boat? Like Darwin did, why did this guy get on a boat? It wasn't, hey, I'm gonna talk about, figure out, and have this theory of evolution by natural selection.
I'm gonna come up with this thing called evolution. No, he was a surgeon and went, wow, that's a lot of blood. I really don't like seeing people die on the operating table. I'm a little bit psychologically scarred. I'm getting out of here. I'm going on a trip.
That's how it worked. The only job he could get while he was on his trip was collecting specimens. And eventually it led him to understand and say, hey, I see this weird variation. Malthus was important. Not all young can survive. That really stuck with Darwin. He really built from that. But Malthus was a very interesting individual in general. And so Darwin's scared at the end, right? He's scared. He's got two books already written up, and he's like, I'm not going to publish these. I'm not gutsy enough. I'm just not going to do it.
And then his buddy sends him a letter, calls him up, right? Sends him a letter and says, hey, I want to publish this. And Darwin says, no way. I already have two of these. If something's going to happen, it's going to have my name on it, all right? If it becomes a pride issue all of a sudden, and the fear goes out the door, and he has to publish. He has to, because he already came up with this. Wouldn't be fair for the other guy to take credit, right?
So, he publishes because he's trying to be macho, not because he thinks it's the right thing to do. We talk about the theory of natural selection, okay? Individuals have to differ.
This is important. Right? I'm going to come back to this and come back to this and come back to this. Okay? So having these points down is going to be important.
The first three set up the last one. Right? The first three set up number four. Individuals have to differ. That differing, that variation, has to be able to be passed on to your kids. It has to be heritable. So you have to have variation. It has to be heritable. Then you've got to go with Malthus. Not enough resources for all the babies, okay? Not all the young can survive. Number four is put all these together. If the variation makes you more likely to survive, there should be more of that variation in the next generation.
Why? Because you are more likely to survive, which means you should be more likely to reproduce, okay? In the same sense,
if it just makes you more likely to reproduce, but doesn't care whether you survive, as long as you hit reproductive age, that's all evolution cares about. Why are we as people not really designed to live as long as we do now?
How do we know this?
Because all we have to do is get reproductive age
and have successful offspring. Originally, making it to 30 was amazing.
Okay, for humans, 30 years old, you were an elder. You were the wisest of the group. Okay? Now we're living to 100, past 100.
There are some really, really interesting, crazy things we're doing. All this modern medicine, where is it really going for us? What's it really doing for us? How much
are we having to kind of fake it to make it that long? We'll talk more and more about that.
But we certainly aren't evolved in a proper way to live that long. Our teeth especially, like, are very obvious for it. We get
one wisdom tooth on each side of the back, right? Really long-lived animals, they just keep pumping them out, okay? Why? Because you have to eat to live, right? You gotta eat to live. Teeth naturally rot. They just do.
You're going to get things in between your teeth, and it's going to rot. Teeth are going to fall out, okay? In long-lived animals, you're going to be able to cycle, right? So that you can always eat.
Well, humans aren't that good at it. We're not really good at it at all. When do our wisdom teeth come in? Around 20, right? In that general area, 18, 20, 22, depending on the person, right, when they first come in. That's supposed to be the wise age, right? Wisdom teeth.
You're supposed to be on your way out when you're getting the wisdom teeth. In our culture, you're on the way in,
right? You're on the way up, okay? So we've done a lot, well, in humanity in general now, even in populations that have low health standards, the health standards are still amazing compared to what they were. Well, the fact that there are health standards is amazing compared to what they were when we were evolving, right? There weren't any health standards. There weren't any people who could really help you when something went wrong.
You either lived or you died. That was it.
So we see this variation. We're going to talk about all these structures next time. This is the next step that we're going to talk about.
But I'm going to go ahead and say these statements first so that you know what I'm going to be talking about. Vestigial structures, things with no remaining function. How about the tailbone in humans or the appendix? No real worth in these structures, but they're there.
Why are they there? Because we evolved, as we were evolving, we had tails previously. And as we went up through great apes, well, only tails.
We have no real good idea what that appendix did. We think it was something with hibernation. We're not sure.
And we think it was something with long-term food storage. Not really hibernation, but long-term food storage. It would potentially allow for hibernation. But, I mean, that's just somebody trying to grasp at straws. There's just no real good statement for it. Homologous structures and analogous structures. A homolog comes from the same thing developmentally. This is kind of tough to explain without going through all of development.
I'm not going to make you go through all of development. But we have different regions that develop into different things. This happens throughout all vertebrates, all animals, okay? We're all coming down the same line, okay? So we have similar ways that we're evolving. We have similar blobs of cells as we evolve, okay? We have similar blobs of cells as we develop, as other vertebrates. These structures, like brain, jaw, they are analogous. They are homologous. They are developed the same way and doing the same function. So the human jaw next to the monkey jaw, okay, the mandible of a human versus the mandible of a monkey are homologous.
Analogous structures seem similar but are different developmentally.
This is the human jaw versus the jaw of a shark. Sharks, reptiles, all the way up there, mammals, we do something really weird. The
bones that make up, or the areas that make up the cartilage for a shark, the bones for reptile and the other animals on that, birds, etc., the bones that make up their jaw, we instead have taken those bones, pulled them up into our ears.
The inner ear ossicles, those are the same structures,
they are homologous structures to the jaw of a shark, okay? So developmentally, they come from the same place as the jaw of that shark.
We use a different piece of bone that we modify to make this mandible. It is a different bone, and it's a one-piece bone. In reptiles, in sharks, they've got multi-piece jaws. Have you ever seen
a reptile skeleton, and now its jaw kind of comes up here, and it's got that branch in it, that suture in it. There are multiple bones here, okay? There are actually multiple bones making up their jaw. Our jaw, and there's a suture in the middle, and then it goes up the other side. Our jaw, this is from the other angle, one suture, right down the middle. The same bone meeting in the middle, bonding together. Eventually, there's no suture in humans. But we're doing the same thing, something, an analog, something analogous with our jaw, to the shark jaw. But it's developmentally very, very different, okay? That's going to be important. I guarantee you we'll talk about that a lot. You can do a lot more with teeth, and a lot more quickly evolutionarily. Teeth you can modify really, really quickly, but that's who knows. That's a who knows kind of thing.
If we just start having pureed food and breed only with people who have no teeth, then, I mean,
you know, if only the people from where I live or used to live breed, then yeah, we're going to have trouble with our teeth, right? We can't know. You can't know. That's why I keep talking about we want diversity. We want diversity. We want diversity in humans, and we want diversity in animals, and we want diversity in plants. We want to keep all these things around
because you don't know what you're going to need until you
need it, in most cases. We're really bad about that. Convergent evolution, very important. When I was talking about wings, the evolution of similar structures to deal with similar problems.
Convergent evolution is key for people like me, okay?
Dealing with problems, and specific problems, result in very similar solutions in animals, evolutionarily. This can help people figure out what the pressures were on animals that aren't existing anymore.
You can look at extant living creatures and predict what's going on with extinct dead creatures.
Okay? Autophagy doesn't recapitulate phylogeny. That, really quickly, development does not show you where you came from evolutionarily.
Just because we're all working on the same path doesn't mean that we have to go through each animal gate to get to human. Okay? As you develop, you don't have to go through and become a bacteria, and then a shark, and then a fish, on the way to becoming a human. You don't have to do that. We make changes in that in different places, but we all start with the same genetic glob, okay? The same genetic read-off, okay? But we have different information on it.
So we all start with... But we write the story differently, okay?
We all started at the beginning. We all have that initial stuff. But where it goes from there can be very, very different.
So, yeah, there was a very, for a while, people were really arguing in biology that we could figure out how we evolved, what steps we went through, by looking at how we developed. That is not.